Greetings, and welcome to CatastropheCast.com. My name is Walter, and today we are going to talk about UPS Flight 6. Okay, you may be asking yourself, you know, why are you covering this topic? Well, it actually is really relevant to the week of January 2013 that I'm actually recording this in. So I'll kind of reveal that towards the end. Anyway, to get back to it, UPS, also known as United Parcel Service, is a true global brand. Just about anywhere, you know, in the world, you can say UPS and people understand what you mean. They fly, you know, throughout the entire world. I think they have operations in 220 countries. It is truly a global brand. They're only second to FedEx, the old Federal Express, in the amount of freight that's been moved around the world. And they're only third behind FedEx and DHL in the size of their cargo fleet, you know, the number of planes they have. They have 230 planes as of, well, the documentation that I have. Anyway, UPS Flight 6 was scheduled service from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates over to a UPS base in Cologne, Germany. It was a 747-400 cargo that was just 3 years old. The plane actually had less than 10,000 hours of service. The captain actually had more hours of service than the plane did, which is somewhat amazing when you think about it, because you tend to think that, you know, a bunch of the old planes, FedEx has just a giant fleet of MD-11s. Those used to carry passengers at one time, but airlines have moved on from having those planes carrying passengers to more simpler, more fuel-efficient planes. You know, why have a three-person flight crew with a captain, co-pilot, and a flight engineer on an MD-11 when you can fly the same amount of passengers for less fuel on a 767 or a 777? So, these two pilots that were flying UPS Flight 6 were based in Anchorage, Alaska, which is actually my hometown. They were flying cargo and on this day left Dubai at 6:53 local time. They were departing for Cologne, just left Dubai, which is right on the Arabian Gulf, and, you know, we're flying over the Arabian Gulf, which that area is very pretty. I've actually flown in that area quite a bit since I did some work over in the United Arab Emirates. So they took off at 6:53 local time. At 7:17 local time, the airplane declared an emergency, saying that they had smoke in the cockpit. So air traffic control actually offered to get them over to Doha, which is about 100 miles away. It was their closest spot that they could have gone safely. But actually, the choice was made not to go back to Doha, about 100 miles away, but rather to fly back to Dubai, which is about 150 miles. Now, if this sounds a little bit familiar to you, if you are someone who follows the different airline crashes from around the world, this actually, to me, totally reminded me of Swissair Flight 111. They also reported smoke in the cockpit. They were offered a close airport or an alternate airport if they wanted, and they actually chose the alternate airport of Boston, which, well, it was the crash of Swissair Flight 111. Those people actually did die. They never made it to either one of their destinations. There is a separate program on that. I'll see if I can find a link to it and post it online over on catastrophecast.com. So, getting back to UPS Flight 6. The plane actually did make it back to Dubai's airspace, but they were too high. They were told to perform a go-around, which they started to do. But before they could complete the entire go-around, a 360-degree turn, which would take them back at a regular altitude, which would be appropriate to land at the airport, they were lost on the radar. And at 7:42 p.m., they crashed into a small construction and car park area. Both pilots on the plane, unfortunately, died. So what happened? Okay, as we go back and look at it, on the climb out from Dubai, just a few minutes into it, there was a fault that happened with the PAC-1 air conditioning system, indicating that there was smoke. So the PAC-1 air conditioning system turned itself off, but the captain reset it. So that was the first thing. There actually is a fire bell that can actually clearly be heard on the cockpit voice recorder if you listen to it. So the pilot, co-pilot actually had been flying the plane at takeoff. When this emergency started to creep up, the captain took back control of the plane and he started flying the plane. 2 minutes later, there was another fire alert. And at this time, both pilots donned their oxygen masks. The PAC-1 air conditioner was turned back off automatically, but neither the pilot nor the co-pilot decided to turn it back on. The crew worked on, you know, all the appropriate checklists. So when you've got an emergency in the air, you have a checklist for just about everything. So you go through the appropriate checklists as you're supposed to. In doing their checklists, they actually turned off PAC-2 and PAC-3 air conditioners. So that means all three of the air conditioner packs were all three turned off. The thing is, this contributed to the smoke situation in the cockpit, and it actually made it much, much worse. They had, you know, no idea at the time, though, that turning off all three air conditioner packs would have that effect. They were not made aware of that. So the captain relayed through his muddled communications. They had their oxygen masks on at this time, and it made it hard to talk to both each other and the people on the ground. So the captain relayed that they were having the problems and was saying, "I'm having some problems controlling the aircraft." He got up from the plane, from his seat, relinquished control back over to the co-pilot, and said that he was going to start looking for oxygen. Now, the one thing that really haunts me about this is that was 7 minutes into the emergency declaration. So that was, you know, whatever, they had left 6:63, they declared about 7:15, so this was about 7:22. The thing is, the captain apparently, from the research that I've done, was actually never heard from again on the cockpit voice recorder. So when he went to go look for oxygen, apparently he never came back. Everything I've read shows that it was just the co-pilot. There was no mention of the pilot coming back. So at this point, captain's gone. Co-pilot is in the room by, in the cockpit by himself. That's, you know, there's 22 minutes left to go until impact. At 8 minutes into the ordeal, the first officer declares a mayday. He said that there was actually so much smoke in the cockpit, he was having problems seeing his instruments. For the next 21 minutes or so until the plane crashes, the first officer got up. He said that he was going to try and find some oxygen, which this is kind of odd. I mean, why are they looking for oxygen if they have their oxygen masks on? That's another part of this little mystery that I did not understand. But, you know, I can do some additional research. I just wanted to be able to kind of point this out. And, you know, when I find out the answer, I'll put it later over on catastrophecast.com. So he starts to look for oxygen and then comes back and immediately asks for vectors to the nearest airport. He manages to get the plane to fly to about 9,000 feet. But, of course, he's flying over Dubai, and he's been advised, you know, you're actually too high, and you're flying much too fast. You're going to have to slow it down, and you're going to have to come down closer before you can do a safe landing. So the first officer, you know, said, you know, that he would do it. But he also mentioned in his communications that not all of his instruments were working. They just were not reacting the same way. I believe one of the things was the speed brakes. He said that he put the speed brakes on. And the speed brake, I believe I've talked about this before, but if you don't know, a speed brake is a flap on a wing. And when you hit the speed brake, what that does is it actually causes the air flowing over the wing, which causes lift. It actually causes that to be spoiled. So the plane basically can slow down and loses altitude. So the one of the things, like I said, he said it was working the speed brakes, but they were not responding. When he, you know, the pilot, co-pilot here is going through his full 360, he couldn't make the full 360, and he actually asked for an alternate at this time. So this was the third airport, you know, first Doha, then Dubai, and now all of a sudden he's being vectored to Sharjah. Sharjah is about 10 miles away to the west of Dubai. He disconnected the autopilot, and at that time the plane started descending into a right turn. And unfortunately, it stayed that way until impact. The plane hit the ground and, of course, started tumbling, sending, you know, engines off. I believe one of the engines flew off into a shed, destroyed the shed. It destroyed a car park area. It destroyed a couple of parked cars. And, of course, those two people on the plane lost their lives. Now, there are two things that came out of this crash. In October 2010, the FAA actually banned large supplies of lithium-ion batteries in cargo when there were passengers on the plane. Now, why'd they do that? Because it appeared that the fire from UPS Flight 6 was actually started by the lithium iron batteries that they were carrying. So the FAA, they had not, you know, there was at the time, there was actually not a definitive answer as to what happened. But knowing, you know, recognizing that this is a threat, in October 2010, the FAA took the steps of banning large quantities of lithium iron batteries in the cargo hold when there are passengers on plane. On airplanes. Now, if you get on a plane today, and, well, I was on a plane yesterday, there's a sign. There should be a sign. There should be notification. There's even oral notifications by the gate agents that say you cannot put anything with a lithium-ion battery in cargo. It has to travel on the plane with you. That's how dangerous these things can be, actually. I mean, you don't think of it like that, but they are. They can be dangerous, especially in larger quantities. They also, the FAA, came out and said that, yes, you know, these planes which have the fire suppression systems in them, that it's got halon, and that really can, you know, that can put out a bunch of fires. The only thing is, halon actually is not effective in fighting fires that are started by the lithium-ion batteries. There's actually one little quote from a website that I can put up, and they said there's actually nothing that can contain the fire or reaction caused by lithium-ion batteries, and that's just mind-blowing. We use these things all the time. I've got one in my laptop. I've got another one over in my iPad. They're everywhere. The thing is, these things can catch fire and be quite dangerous. The second thing that came out of this was, as I said earlier, all three air conditioning packs, you know, were turned off on the plane. The pilots at the time had no idea that turning all three off meant that they were basically ensuring that they were going to have more smoke in the cockpit, because you have to have at least one of these air conditioning packs on, either pack one or pack three, to keep the smoke out of the cockpit itself. So one of the good things that came out of this crash is that Boeing changed all their checklists and said that, you know, on this plane, if you are flying and you have some sort of smoke, that you have to leave on either pack one or pack three, and that will help minimize the smoke in the cockpit. Now, I mean, think of it this way. I mean, like I said, when I get on a plane, I've got my laptop. It's got lithium ion in it. I've got a phone. I've got an iPad. Those have lithium ion batteries in it. I've got a mouse that I keep at my desk up in Seattle. It's got lithium ion batteries in it. So I carry spare batteries with me. I've got a bunch of lithium ion with me. This is some stuff that we use every day. And it actually caused such a fire that it brought down a fully laden 747. That's just amazing. If you actually do some more research on this, you'll actually see that there's several fires that have started. A UPS DC-8 in, I believe it was Philadelphia, caught fire and burned right after touchdown. That plane was destroyed, attributed to lithium ion batteries. There was another plane that was destroyed at Los Angeles International Airport, attributed to the batteries, a pallet of batteries that had caught fire and set fire to another pallet, which destroyed the entire plane. So in doing research for this podcast, one of the things that I found was a website, which I'm actually quite familiar with. It's howstuffworks.com. They actually do a whole bunch of podcasts. They range from, you know, from How Stuff Works to conspiracy theories and such. So there's a whole bunch of stuff out there. And actually, as a little side note, I want to say my own thanks to Josh and Chuck from How Stuff Works, or actually their Stuff You Should Know podcast, and Sarah and Deblina from the Stuff You Missed in History podcast. Just a little shout out to them. If you haven't heard their podcast, they're pretty great. Josh and Chuck actually have a show starting up really soon, which is pretty awesome, on the Science Channel. And they focus on literally stuff you should know, you know, how body farms work, how a battery can actually cause a fire. And then Sarah and Deblina, they tackle different things from history, from the Bronte sisters to famous writers, to famous villains, to the first serial killers. So they have a whole bunch of stuff, different things that you can listen to. So anyway, little shout out to them. But on this How Stuff Works website article, it actually goes into the background on lithium ion batteries, how they're put together and how they can start fires. And part of that has to do with overheating from overcharging. Now, like I said, I work in a separate city from where I live. I live in Oregon, and right now I live in Oregon, and I work in Washington. I have actually often plugged in my rechargeable batteries on a Saturday or Sunday while I'm at home, and then forget to unplug them until the following week when I'm back. I'm not doing that anymore. I don't want to overcharge these batteries. I don't want to cause a fire. So if you have rechargeable batteries that you're using, be careful. So as I said at the beginning of the podcast, why am I talking about this? You know, why would I choose this? And like I said, it would be totally relevant to actually current events that are happening the week that I'm recording this in January 2013. If you know anything about airplanes or pay any attention to them, of course, Airbus came out with the A380, their super jumbo double-decker. And, you know, because they're betting on the fact that those planes are going to, the future of flight is going to be carrying a whole bunch of people to one destination. Whereas Boeing took a different approach. They're saying, we're going to focus on a little bit of a smaller plane, but it's going to be much more efficient, and it's going to be able to carry a group of people, not as many as an A380, but a group of people as far. So this week, as a matter of fact, so I'm recording this on Friday, January 18th. This week, the FAA has actually grounded the Boeing 787. And this happens after there were three incidents that happened in Boston with the 787. There was an emergency landing yesterday of a 787. So the FAA has actually taken the tact of, we're going to ground the 787. So that right now, the 787 cannot be flown in America, in Europe, or Asia. Why? Well, I'm going to put a picture up on catastrophecast.com. You need to look at it. It's the lithium ion based battery that Boeing chose to be their APU, auxiliary power unit, in the 787. Over in Boston, there was a fire in a cargo hold for a plane that had just landed from Japan. They took it out. You know, they basically, that happened on January 7th. In the subsequent 11 days, you know, they have gone through, dissected it, find out what happened. And there is a picture of this lithium-ion battery that Boeing chose for all of their 787s that is just a charred, burned-out hull of its former self. So that's the tie-in. Anyway, there we go. I wanted to just put this one out there. I know it's a little bit of a quicker one. But I wanted to also say that we're going to be having a couple of more podcasts coming up pretty soon. They are both listener-suggested podcasts, which is awesome. There is a contact us or a tell us what you want to hear post, both of those on catastrophecast.com. I encourage you to go out there and, you know, tell me what you want to hear. The first podcast that we're working on, it's actually a smaller event that happened in Spain in the 1970s. And because it happened in Spain, because it was in the 70s, there's not as much documentation on it, but it is an interesting catastrophe that I want to delve into. So that's taking a little bit of a long time to research because most of the documentation is in Spanish. And the second is actually probably the largest catastrophe of all time, at least in terms of loss of life. And that one is just going to be massive in research. So it's going to be real and interesting. So if you've got something you want to hear, if you want me to do a podcast on a catastrophe that you know of yourself, something that you don't know much about but you'd like to know more of, or something all, you know, whatever, I invite you to come over to catastrophecast.com. There is the contact us link that you can send me an email, or there's a static post at the top of the webpage that says, you know, let us know what you want to have Walter podcast about. So either one of those, perfectly fine. I want to thank the two folks who left me the suggestion so far. And want to thank you for listening. Keep those ideas coming. Thanks for listening.